Succession number 22077, reel 40.
His name was Smith. The colonel was Abel Smith, third or fourth cousin to Her Majesty the Queen at the time. And his son was in my wife's class at school in Brussels. They'd moved then to Islam. I saw the colonel, very nice chap, Abel Smith, and he said, well, Metcalf, there are only three men it could be. There's only three horses been out this morning, Sizes. They take their horses out. And they're so-and-so. And if I would think now, they would be in the stables brushing down their horses. I went to the stables, and there were three soldiers there brushing down their horses, laughing their heads off, if you please. We walked in, and the girl said, "Yah, yah." And there, you could have seen their faces, these blokes. I arrested them, took them back to my section. By which time, Harry Hackney, my sergeant, had come from his wife's place. He even married a German girl. And one other of my sergeants came as well. So I said, you look after these two while I interview these people. Then one of my other sergeants came in, and I said, right, first one come in here. And he came in, and he didn't know what to do. I cautioned him, and he started to cry. And I was so angry, I could have got up and smoked him. You know, I really was mad about this. Anyway, he made a statement admitting that he had done it. And I said to Sergeant Hackney, my sergeant, I said, Harry, if the next bloke comes in and cries, I'll smash his bloody face in. And the bloke came in and stood in the corner and he started to cry. And I got up and Harry said, no, sir, no, no. And I sat down and I was really angry. I really was. They all made statements admitting, okay? None of them tried to get out of it at all. They got 5 years each, sent home. I'm telling you this because I'm going right off the record now. Many years later, I was working at a company in Bristol called Metal Agencies Company, and I was the chief security officer there. And one of the counter hands came round and he said, Mick, I said, yes. He said, what's the trouble? And he said, didn't any trouble. There's a bloke out there. He's got a smashing car, he said. Alfa Romeo, beautiful. And he said to me, did I hear you say Mr. Metcalf? And he said, yes, they've been talking on the counter about cricket or something. And he said, is Mr. Metcalf here? And this bloke said, yes, he's my security officer. He said, could I see him? So they brought this bloke round to my office, and immediately he came in. I've always in my section, wherever I've been, I had this, I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. What I can do, I ought to do, and by the grace of God, I will. I had this in real good script, I used to do it, and I had this wherever I went. And when he was in my office, of course, it was above his head. I'm saying above his head, because he said to me, you must be RSM Metcalf. I said, how do you know? He said, my name's so-and-so, and I'm one of the men who raped the girl in Iselong. Can you believe this? I'm not joking. And we sat there and talked, and I said, what?
Harold Morris Metcalf, end of reel 13. Harold Morris Metcalf, reel 14. So he'd recognised you.
Yes.
And, yeah.
And I said, what happened to you then? He said, well, I did 4 years, and then I was sent home, and my father, who's quite a snob, he was going to disinherit me, and he said in the end my mother talked him out of it, and he said he got me a job, and I work for him now. That's the car my dad gave me. And he said, I just wanted to tell you something. He said, you know what happened, I expect, Mr. Metcalf, because the girl came to our office sometime later, and she, through the interpreter, Gerda, said she's very upset, Mr. Metcalf. I said, what is it? And she said, well, she's a Catholic girl, and the thing is that she can't say her Lord's Prayer. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, every time she comes to and forgive those who trespass against us, she can't go on any longer. And she wants to write to these men to tell them that she forgive them. And I had to get permission, of course, because it wasn't allowed. The brigadier, very nice chap he was, he said, all right, Metcalf, I can quite see the point. And they allowed the girl to write. I knew nothing more about it after that. But this chap said, she got someone to write to me. And I became a Christian as a result of this. It's a funny old world, isn't it? But that's what happened that morning, this chap. And my wife and I were quite overjoyed, you know, when I came home and told her, she wouldn't believe it. I wrote to Gerda and told her, because Gerda had married one of my sergeants then, who was then a lieutenant. He became a major. And I saw him last year, and her. But she was over the moon, Gerda, about the whole thing. So was I. I think she came friendly with the girl, actually, for a while in Iserlohn. She lived at Lettmatta. But that was one of my worst cases in Germany.
What was the main run-of-the-mill cases for you in Germany?
We had
a lot. I mean, I imagine there was hunting down of Gestapo and things, and you know, there was a lot of some mistrust about.
No,
as well as
that was done by the security sections. We had, I forget what they are. Field FSS, the field security section, their offices were two houses down from us. We had a lot to do with each other, but they did all that sort of thing. Right. We did more crime. They did that sort of thing.
Right. Yes. I was just trying to get the atmosphere of the community at that
quite.
Time. There must have been a lot of mistrust.
Well, when I first got to Iserlohn, things weren't very good. During the years I spent there, I met lots of people who I got to like, and through the chief of police, of course, he used to come to my house for music. He loved music, and we had quite a few friends. And then we had a YMCA run by five girls, Mrs. Mitchell Thompson, who got the OBE she got. When she came home after the service, she was a wonderful woman. She really was. Tomo, she's dead now, of course, but not of course, but she's gone now. And I've forgotten the girls' names now, but we belonged to a group there, amateur theatricals, yes? Mm-hmm. And we were going to do a religious play called In the Beginning. And my wife was an angel, and I was a chap who had to rescue the soldier, you know, sort of business. And we put this thing on at Bad Oeynhausen. It was done by all the regiments in Germany, and civilian things as well. And we were upset. It was a wonderful show. It really was a wonderful show. And the chap who did the wounded soldier who died, he was the most funny lad, and yet he was so brainy. We kept in touch for years, and when his dad died, he said, you know, I've never told you that my dad got an OBE for something. You know, it was strange, Randy, but he's gone now too. But he was a scruff. You couldn't make him smart, you know what I mean? And one night, he'd been out, he was a very, very avid runner and walker. He did all sorts of things, and he gathered fossils and things like that. And he came to our house for tea, and he'd been out all day, and he was in a shocking state. I said, you can't go to church like that. And I loaned him one of my uniforms, which didn't fit him, but I had to take the badges off, you see. And I've always remembered when we got there, the first girl who saw him, Susan, she said, oh my God, where'd you get him from? He's never seen him so smart. But the YMCA was a focal point, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. It was, although that, I mean, fraternisation, I suppose, wasn't completely banned
later on.
For, I suppose it wasn't encouraged, though, was it?
It was about 2 years after we arrived there, you were allowed to talk to Germans. Mm. Yeah? In fact, my sergeant major, Harry Hackney, he married a girl. He died in Egypt, actually, Harry. And I was in England when he got married. No, I was at his wedding. But when they went to Egypt, I was home. So I missed his farewell party. But we've kept in touch with her all the years. And she still lives in Iserlohn, but she was most upset when Harry went. I never thought he'd marry a German girl, but he spoke German fluently, by the way, Harry. And so the people of Iserlohn were real countryish folk, you know what I mean? There was a good mixture. We had no trouble at all, really, with civilians much there. It was the boot was always on the other foot. It was the men who raped the German girls, etc., etc., you know. And there was a bit black market, I admit. We had a friend named Herta Gross. My wife was teaching in the BFES school at the time. And Herta was a pianist. And we became very friendly. Unfortunately, she had been with one of my sergeants and they were going to get married. And he was posted away. And she was most upset because he left her with a baby in the pod. And Herta's boy, lovely kid he is now, but she married another man many years later, and one from the NAFI department. We have met since, they live at Wareham now. And she became a model for the group she was working for at that time. One of our big stores over here, you know, had, and she was quite a pretty girl. And she used to come to my house practically every night to play and sit with the kids. So Herta was, she was a great friend of ours, and so was our maid, who became my typist interpreter after Gerda. I met them at a big reunion last year down at, in one of the, Brighton. We went to Brighton for a year and Julie couldn't go. But I think Iserlohn was a rather more quiet place than the next station up. We had quite a lot of sections in that area, North Rhine-Westphalia. The one thing that I would like to say to you now is there was a morning when I was called by headquarters. Metcalf, you will be receiving a message from 2 Infantry Div very shortly. Make certain you understand everything that's said because it's quite important. I had a call from my major, Major Sexton. He said, Metcalf, I want you to pack your section up immediately and get down here. I said, what's this all about, sir? I cannot tell you. Don't say anything to your wives. You don't know how long you'll be away. So I went over to the school and said to Julie, I'm away. I don't know what's happening. Get down to Brussels, to Dusseldorf, the Kripo headquarters, the police presidium not Wuppertal. What did I say then? Our headquarters at Dusseldorf. And by 11 o'clock that morning, there were 4 sections of SIB and 4 sections of military police gathered in this place with 2 German police officers from the German police. And we were told that Nazism was riding again. There was going to be a big do that very night. Yes?
What year would this be?
Oh, God. 49? I would think it would be 49. It must have been, yes, 49. And we were all... No one will leave this building until this evening when we all go together. Now, this is what's going to happen. There was this chap, I've forgotten his name now. I should have remembered it because it was quite important. But anyway, we were to go down to this place where the house was supposed to have a lot of Nazi material that is going to be distributed at the same time as all the others were in Germany. So all the sections in Germany were on the alert at this particular time. We went down with the German police that night to this particular house. Great big wall around it, big gate. And I can remember Major Sexton said, well, how are we going to climb the wall, Metcalf? I said, well, what do we want to climb the wall for? Why don't we go and open the gate and walk in? What? No one's going to see us. So we went, we opened the gate and walked in. And when we got to the door, we rang the bell, and a lady came out, and I asked her name, and I said, is here so-and-so in? Yeah. But she was obviously agitated, and we walked in, and he was sitting down at the table, and my colonel said, we are going to search your house. The German policeman interpreted it to him. We found reams and reams and reams of Nazi material. He was arrested, and I had to take him back to a place called Vell, where the Canadians had a prison camp. He never spoke a word to me on the way up. It was freezing cold. He was handcuffed, by the way. There were two other blokes in my Jeep. We went to the prison at Vell, and we got out, and I said, it was freezing cold. The Canadian sergeant said, undo his handcuffs, strip him off. They stripped him right down. It was bloody freezing. I've always remembered this, you know. And before he went, he just said to me, England expect every man do his duty. I've never forgotten it, because my sergeants are laughing their heads off. But they arrested I don't know how many people that night. It was a real do. It was quite serious. I don't know whether it ever got in the Bristol, in the English papers or no, but that was 49. It nipped it in the bud straight away. Yeah. So that was our biggest job. And it was nothing in it, really, as far as I was concerned, but that was one of our big jobs. We had a lot of work in Ease Alone, and I got to know the pathologist very well. Mary Monroe, Major Mary Monroe, she was, and she was brilliant at her job. And I had to go down one day, a chap was there, and she said, my sergeant had been a policeman, by the way, this particular sergeant, and I said, you come down with me today, there's a post-mortem. And we went down there, and she's, matter of fact for her, she didn't care tuppence, and I'd seen her quite a while. And she took some organs, and she gave them to my sergeant and said, put them in that bucket, and he fainted. I've never forgotten. He was a great big bloke, and nothing would ever worry him, you know. It was all on the section by the time we got back. But she was a wonderful woman, and we had one case. I had to go to a place just up the line from us where a soldier was found on the line, and they didn't know what had happened. And so I went there, and I found out with whom he'd been out the night before, and these chaps said, well, we don't know what happened, sir. He got drunk and he buggered off, you know, and we don't know anything about it. We didn't even see him. When we went for the train, we couldn't find him. Well, there he was on the line, you know. And he was as dead as a doornail. I couldn't find out anything at the moment, except that a train had left at a certain time, going to Bremen or something. And that was all I had. We took the body back to our place, or an ambulance took it back. And Mary Monroe and I sat down there talking, and she said, have you seen that peculiar marks on his forehead? And I said, yes. She said, what could they be? I said, well, I really don't know. But we're checking on a train at the other end of the journey. Well, when I spoke to the sergeant major from the other end, I said, can you tell me the sort of handles on the train? He said, well, they're funny, Mick. They're sort of a handle, but they got circles, you know, embedded metal circles. And that's what was on his forehead. Yes, the marks were quite plain on his forehead. And the assumption was, and don't get me wrong, he was drunk, and they thought that he had leant forward or bent down, and the train door was open, and as it came by, it smashed his head in, and he fell between between the platform and the rail. And that was all we ever thought about. That we never found anything else. There was no suspicion at all about the job at all. So that was that. And, I couldn't tell you all the jobs I had in Germany, of course, because you'd be here all night as well. But it was a busy, busy time.
Yes. I suppose as the years went on, I mean, then there was the Berlin airlift and all those
things. Very bad, that was, by the way, during that time. Mm.
Where were you when the airlift was
coming? In Iserlohn. Mm-hmm. And I'd been to Berlin twice to play football and cricket on the Olympic Stadium. Very, very nice it was. I did sport quite a bit with my colonel, and I were mad keen on cricket anyway. But I was trying to think what happened at the Berlin thing, but it doesn't matter. It wasn't nothing to do with me at the time. The airlift was quite a bit of a... We used to hear them going over every night, you know. And I mean, things at Berlin, the section at Berlin had a very bad time. I know that from chaps I talked to later. And Julia worked with a lady in Brussels whose husband was on the control commission, CCG, Germany. And he was posted to Berlin. And I had to go there to play cricket for 5 days. And they invited me to their home in Berlin. And he said to me, her husband, charming woman she was, American, by the way, and she was teaching with Julie in Brussels, and he said, how would you like to come across into East Berlin? I said, I'm not supposed to. He said, neither am I, but we're going. And we went through Checkpoint Charlie across. Well, there was nothing to see, really, but we had been over. I went there again after later years, but I spent a couple of evenings with them. They're very nice folk. Forgotten her name now, and gone out of my mind. We kept in touch with them for a long time when they went back. And then I wasn't very pleased when I was suddenly called in one day and told that I was to be a warrant officer one and to go to headquarters, because I'd had my section, my own section, all the time I'd been out. So I was then going in with my major and my captain and a lieutenant and another sergeant major. And I wasn't upset about it. I was very pleased, in fact, to be promoted. But Julie wasn't very pleased because we had to move to Dusseldorf. And we had two quarters because they weren't big enough for our two children and us. And Julie spent quite a lot of time getting it sorted out. And I was on a murder inquiry. An officer was subsequently charged, but I was gone by that time. I'd been out for 4 days doing another inquiry, and then I was called back to carry on with this inquiry with my major, Major Sexton. And once we were out, a call came through at this place and said, Mr. Metcalf has to report back to headquarters. So he said, what the hell's up with this then? And I said, I don't know, sir. I went back to headquarters. And we were going to be posted to Egypt with my captain, who wanted me to go. But as I'd been promoted WO, there was no appointment for a WO1, and he couldn't take me, you see. But all my presents, my Christmas stuff had gone home because we were going to be posted. No fear. What happened when I got back? You're going to Korea. That's what I was told. And of course, when I got home and told my wife, she was nearly in tears. She spent a couple of weeks getting the ruddy quarter ready and so on. So there I was, going to Korea.
Right. So, I mean, there must have been amongst lots of servicemen this fear that they could be sent on to Korea if they stayed in the army. So a lot of people must have been wanting to get out.
Lots of them. Oh, yes. Again. Yeah. I had signed for 21 years by that time, of course, because I'd already done, I enlisted in 30. We're now talking about 40, 41,
43. 49 we got to, we'd done the Berlin airlift.
Oh, yes, yes, of course.
Yes,
yeah. 53.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I had to leave and I went out. The ship.
Which ship did you go on?
What the hell was the ship I went out on? I ought to know because
you went as a military policeman.
Yes, oh yes. I was in charge of five other sergeants who were being posted.
Okay.
And when I got on board, by the way, on the ship,
so you're now warrant officer one.
Yes, I'm WO1. And the RSM came to me and he said, the only quarter that's left really, Mick, is with the crew. Do you mind? I said, not at all. And I was smashing. I had my tea brought to me in the morning and all that. So, you know, I was an RSM. And, I mean, an RSM's a bit of a toss, you know. And I found it out. Entree into many places I wouldn't have done otherwise. The first night on the ship, I was asked if I would be in charge of the tombolo. Because they wanted someone they could trust, I suppose, with the money. And we had a Scots regiment on board. They were wonderful chaps, really. They were very helpful all the time.
You know which regiment they were?
No, I don't know whether they're Cosbys. I'm not quite sure whether they were Kings or Scottish Borders. I think they were, but I couldn't remember now. But they were wonderful chaps, I know that. And there were other regiments as well, little platoons, but they were a battalion. And it was a lovely ship. Wasn't the Asturias, I'm sure. Anyway, they asked me to look after the Tombolo, and I shouted as well, I called as well. Whilst I'm shouting, an officer comes up, and he says, "I don't bloody believe it, he's a major." And he said, "It's Mick Metcalf, isn't it?" And I looked round and I couldn't believe it. He was a chap who taught me the Polo in the Gloucesters. Yeah, Mickey Walker. And he was a major in the physical training corps now. He'd been a physical trainer. He boxed with me and all. And he said, "When you finish, Mick, come to my cabin. I want you to meet my wife." Well, when we finished, I did all the money up, took it to the RSM. And I went to his cabin and I walked in and she said, "Hello, Mick." I said, "Oh, Maisie." It was Maisie Rigdon, the daughter of my sergeant major in India. We were kids together. We used to go to the Sunday school together. Maisie Rigdon, he married. I met them all when I came back to England because he was in charge of the Dawn Dreams Trust in this city, Mick Walker. And we had a, but that's another story. And I had a good trip to Korea. I hadn't been there long when the war stopped.
So where did you go when you got to Korea?
A place called Pusan. That's the docks. Yes. And then our section was in Seoul. The capital city. Section was at Seoul and I had a major, captain, lieutenant, myself as RSM. And I wasn't to stay there, I was to go to Japan. But I stayed there long enough till the war finished and I got a medal, of course, because if you're there over 10 days during the war, wherever you were, that happened in all stations. And what can I say about it? I went back quite a few times, but my first visit to Korea, it was awful. The arid country. Outside of the towns, it was awful. You wouldn't think anything could survive. And I mean, I went four or five times eventually, back and forth. And I thought, what the hell did they fight over this for, really? And whilst I was there, I went up the line with my colonel and we weren't on an inquiry. I was being taken round to see the regiments that were there over the 38th parallel. And we went to the Norfolk regiment, yes? Or was it the Suffolk? Suffolk, from Newmarket. Now, Mrs. Buckle had a son, Derek. I didn't know that. Well, I mean, I knew that he was a nice little lad. He was in the scouts and so on. But he was in the Suffolk regiment, a corporal. And I had been told this. And I went up the line and the RSM said to me, "Do you know anything about my mob?" And I said, "Well, not really." I said, "But I do know a chap called Corporal Buckle." And he said, "Oh, he's a nice lad. Nice lad, Buckle." And he said, "I'll fetch him up and see you." And I can see him now. He stood there in front of me and said, "Hello, sir, Uncle Mick." Isn't it funny, eh? And my colonel couldn't get over this till I told him what the score was. But I stayed there for a while, and then I went back to Japan, where it was my original posting.
So what impression did you get? I mean, did you see soldiers returning to Pusan? Because they evacuated people through Pusan, didn't they?
I didn't really want to go into this with you. How can I put it? The Gloucesters were there. My regiment. You know all about it, probably. And I had a letter only the other day from one of them. The only one of them I know, Reg Panting. But he said, when I met Reg when he came out, I was up near Panmunjom at the time.